Welcome back to Extra Features. And today we have an actor, director, writer, cook. Who knows what else this man does? His film is Trouble Is My Business. It's Tom Kunkel. Hey, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. It was nice when you reached out and we had an opportunity to chat online. And, you know, with any independent film, it's always a pleasure when someone takes an interest because really the thing is discovery at this point. We put a lot of work into it and now we're trying to have it out there that it's available.
Yeah, I think that's a big problem with independent film, and as you write, nobody knows you guys exist. And that's not just your film, that's all independent film.
I would have to agree with you. I was having a conversation with Mike Smith, the guy that exec produced it with me, and we were saying, in reality, if as a smart business plan, you almost have to take the budget and then take the budget again, you know, double it, and say that amount is going to have to go to publicity and to getting it out there and buying Facebook ads and doing all the things, because often when you build it, they don't come.
I agree.
Yeah, and it doesn't, you know, it doesn't really behoove you when you put a lot of work into it, or even if you have a good film, if it's not discovered, it's difficult to get it out of there. One of the reasons I picked film noir, actually, ironically, was in the 40s and 50s. That was the studio's low-budget indie film. They shot those lean, unlike MGM, who would spend $1 million on a set and go, I want to see it, you know, set up the lights, I want to see everything. With film noir, you're like, no, it's about faces, and the shadows fall off, and you don't miss any of the spectacle of it because it's about the sort of dark human drama. But they shot those because those were lean, little films where you didn't have a lot of resources to blow things up all the time. It all had to be internal, and it had to be kind of the twisted attitude of the characters, and the execution of the story was in the visuals and in the words, and that doesn't cost anything.
Is that what drew you to make a film noir film then? Because you're a lover of those things?
I am, but I think it's more than that. I think for me it was two things. It was an intellectual exercise because I was trying to pick something that I wanted to see. And what I didn't want to do was what I call the blue jeans and t-shirt type of indie film where it's, you know, two guys sitting on a sofa talking about zombies and it's in one room. And you can do that, and there certainly have been good versions of it, but I didn't want to do that. So I thought, how do I challenge myself? You know, Luminactus is my company that I want to do great genre B movies. The way movies used to be, you know, in the 80s, where you'd roll something out and it was well crafted, but it wasn't expensive. And I thought, you know, I love film noir. And I had this idea of the forensics. Information traveled much slower in the 40s. And there were no DNA typing and forensics. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be interesting to use our biases now about how fast information could travel and use that against us by going, wow, you know, if you found blood, you couldn't type it. You didn't know whose blood it was. If you were looking for somebody, you didn't put them on the internet. You had to drive and show people the picture. And I thought, wow, okay, with this modern perspective, how would I formulate, you know, if I took a book off the shelf from the 40s, how would I formulate a noir story now, knowing what I know now? Period. And so I started with that premise of I had the idea, which having seen the movie, you kind of know the idea, which is how do you hide a body because nobody, no crime. But also if you wake up and there's evidence, you can't just have CSI come rolling in and go, oh, this is who, what this is. And everything. No, days happen and you can manipulate people because as the theme stated in the film is information is more priceless than things. You know, I think it's no secret that they're after this diamond, but there's a great line in it where the character Lou McDonald says, look, I can't do anything with a diamond. I can't buy a sandwich with it. I would get arrested. But information, that's everything. And I think that resonates today now more than ever because we are an information society. Companies that sell information are worth more than companies that make things. And I thought, well, there's an interesting way to use noir, which was lean and stylized, but still make it relevant, where you have cop corruption, information versus things, all these things kind of in there so that it still speaks to us, but it also is dreamlike because it's one step removed. It's kind of like science fiction. You can talk about things indirectly, But because it's set in the past and because it is a noir attitude, you could be more eloquent than you would in real life, if that makes sense.
It does. I think you've gotten that way across in your film.
Thank you.
That information is more important than the diamond.
Yes.
And I think that rolls out late in the film. Not so much early, because he's got to gather information early. We don't know anything. He doesn't know anything.
Yes. Ironically, as a private investigator, he sells information.
He does.
You know, the fact that he had incorrect information, that information was used against him, is what ruined him. And then when we introduce the information that is more valuable than what we think we're after, we realize, that's just a human thing, that control and the flow of information and what you can do with it is far more priceless, because you can have these things, but unless there's some place you could fence it or whatever, who goes in and buys a car with a Hope Diamond, right?
Yes. I want to go over your filming of this. Now, I have to ask, because you have me fooled. Is it CGI'd or is it real location?
It's both.
That's what I thought. Because that roadway, I was convinced, was real.
Oh, yeah. They're definitely. Any organics like that, CGI doesn't tend to hold up as well, particularly on our budget level.
Well, I wasn't Because I thought maybe you knew somebody with a soundstage. It's possible.
It's possible, but at great expense. You have to rent. There's a lot of render time, and there's a lot of sort of engineering of the shots. And, you know, as a director, I'm kind of in both worlds. I'm an actor, so I understand the staging of a scene and how it feels to be an actor, and even an actor immersed in a visual effects scene, how you need to communicate that environment so that you get something out of the performers. But also, I understand the technical side. And when I was working with Mike Smith about it, we kind of value engineered the shots to get the most bang for the buck. And the biggest compliment is when you say something like, well, it kind of feels like there was a, obviously my brain is going, they didn't really film that, but that's the best effect, where you're kind of like, okay, it's a little surreal, maybe hyper-real, but I'm kind of in the world. And I made a compromise. I was like, look, with what I can do, it's slightly heightened reality, but the visual effects are just in service of creating environments that would be near impossible to either recreate or do today without, you know, spending $50 million. Or most period films, let's face it, I think Gangster Squad was a $100 million film.
For sure.
You know? And so I was like, well, we're not going to do that. But then again, Warner Brothers didn't do that in 1947.
Correct.
So I started thinking about it, and I was like, well, okay, we're going to do set extensions, and we're going to heighten what we need to. But a surprising amount of that film is shot on locations.
I thought things
like the cemetery, and anytime you're outside on the street or you see some, you know, stuff in his office, all that, there are slight set extensions, or it's more about removing things that were not of the period. Like, for example, Drake's apartment. You know, that is a 1930s house, but of course it was upgraded. But little subtle things you shouldn't notice, like the thermostat on the wall, that's replaced with a thermostat from the 1940s. So that you're just like, yeah, there it is. You know, of course there wouldn't be a vent for central air conditioning, so the wall is smooth. And it's stuff like that that is the most subtle. I think the biggest compliment I ever got was we went to a film festival, and we won a couple of them, and one of them, I saw the categories in visual effects, and we were nominated. And there are 2,000 visual effects in the film. And I said, how come we weren't nominated? And the festival director goes, well, I mean, to be honest, there's just not that many effects in your movie.
What?
Because he completely believed it. You know, he was like, God,
there's so many. It's evident to me that they're there.
But they're very subtle. You know, they're like a wall somewhere, or they're, you know, whatever. And so people are more used to going, well, that's a spaceship. I know that doesn't exist. Or, you know, that cable car is probably real, you know. And so people tend to, their brains fill it in. Things that are more obviously visual effects-driven genres tend to get nominated faster. But I'm okay with that, because it means he didn't notice that all the, you know, the plugs on the wall are real 1938 plugs.
I definitely didn't. I think the acting is very strong and your dialogue's really strong, so I gotta admit, I wasn't wandering.
Right.
Like, looking for things. Like, it just threw me off. I'd say the first 20 minutes I had to settle down.
Uh-huh.
And just accepted that, okay, this is the world, let it go. Don't, looking for effect shots.
Right.
Cause it took me a few minutes. And I was at the beginning, cause I'm like, okay, he's doing, I know what you're doing. Okay, yeah, yeah. Oh, stop. Stop and enjoy the film, because I'm going to miss things. It's a detective story. I need to follow.
Yes, that is
true. And you give me tons of facts as I go. They're all there.
Well, that's the thing. At the end of the day, it's about faces. To me, acting is thinking loudly. And so if you are drawn into characters that are reasonably interesting and they have a kind of a stillness about them sometimes and levels of things going on, I really rehearsed it, you know, when we were staging it like a play, because I wanted to have movement within the frame. And if things could happen in a two shot, I let it happen in a two, because those rhythms, you know, in modern film, you would be cut, 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 all, you know, cut to every head that talks and cut to different angles and all, you know. But I thought, well, you know, if John Huston and Orson Welles had a red camera, what would they do? Actually, they'd have somebody step forward in the frame. They'd have someone in the background, and they'd close the distance in a two, and they'd make it a one-er and make it all work. And so I tried to discipline myself to do that. And I was watching performance more than anything else, which I think a lot of people that get caught up in effects or the showiness of something, it's like, oh, you know, I got to have the shadow right, or that lamp is just off. It's like, you know what? Performance trumps everything. If it wasn't perfect, perfect, but the performance was good, I always went for the performance.
I agree. I'm totally into it. So let's just start there. Obviously, you're the main character in the film.
Yeah.
And your female lead, where'd you find her?
Brittany and I, we started working together in 2008. We got cast in something together. We actually met at an audition. We got cast together in something. We ended up doing six or seven projects together where they were just like, oh, your chemistry is great and everything. And we actually became great friends. And when I started thinking about the film, one mandate I gave myself was, I said, wouldn't it be interesting to have male and female energy in a screenplay for a noir? Because it's quite rare to have a woman input into a noir script. And because Brittany looks sort of genetically designed to be a femme fatale.
She does?
I kind of pushed her into the Veronica Lake mode a little bit. Jane Greer, you know, from Out of the Past. Yeah. And she had never been cast in something like that. She was always cast as the ingenue when she was younger. We've been actors for about 20 years. And she's like, you know what? I've never been able to give a more mature performance. I've always been, you know, the girl on the beach or this or contemporary thing. And I was like, I know there's that darkness in you and complexity. Why don't we give ourselves permission to act together in this, but see ourselves in a new light? And because she and I are a great team, we kind of shorthanded it. Like, we rehearsed this thing like it felt like His Girl Friday. We would just run. We would run five pages just like, and just have it cold, and we'd know each other's rhythm. I knew when I needed to stop for a minute to give her a beat. She knew when she needed to give me something. And so when we did that opening office scene, it's really the two of those characters circling each other with a change in dynamic and power. And my decision was, whoever was seated at the moment was not in power, and whoever was above them was in power. And so if you watch the film with the sound off, you know exactly when she's over him convincing him, when he challenges her, when they're equals, and then when it unbalances again at the end. And it's all about height, distance, and closing the negative space between them. And that sort of choreography happens effortlessly under tons of dialogue. And for me, I was like, okay, well, you know, I don't have explosions, but I do have this, and I do have a way of visually showing the relationship. So when she comes in and sits on the desk and I'm seated, she's got everything. Then all of a sudden when she goes to step away, it's in that great, you know, both faces east two shot. But then she sits down and he's over her and starts really questioning her. Then when she rises up, that's when she presents the premise of the film, which is, are you going to help me? And then, and from the next time you meet the sister, he's on the ground again. He's dropped the pencil again, and he's looking up, and she's got the gun, and she's over him again. And then that whole dance happens again with them ending up seated across from each other, and now they're equals again. And I was like, that's an elegant, interesting way of showing the relationship without working too hard to kind of like, oh, she's this or that. It's like, no, by showing the staging and relative positions of the two of them, it says everything you need to know about their power struggle and their flirtation, but also she's using him in an interesting way because he's broken in that environment. Even the first line is, I don't even feel like I belong in my own office. So when she walks in and he's being evicted from his life, she's his lifeline, he's willing to believe certain things that she's presenting, which are classic noir tropes, which are, I'm blackmailing you, I've got this diamond, I need this, I just need you to help me get out of this. And once we're into that premise, then we can play in that world a little bit. But I needed to establish my character and her character. And I really dug deep with Roland Drake. I was like, I really want to do a good job with this guy. I need to find the everyman in him. But to me, he's every friend you've ever had that you see him heading for a brick wall. And you're like, dude, you're heading to a brick wall. You're going to hit that brick. Okay, hit that brick wall. They don't listen, even if they're smart people. He's kind of a knight in, you know, I say rusty armor. He's got this sense of, he's like a dog in a bone. He's like, I'm going to find the answer to this, even if it destroys me. And he falls for somebody that he knows he shouldn't love. And you even see at a certain point, he knows this is going bad, but he can't stop.
Oh, I'm totally on board with you. I totally love what you're saying. I think it's great. I just want to go over a few of the locations before we go a little bit deeper. Sure. The restaurant. I love the restaurant scene.
Yes, that is the last real 40s diner in Los Angeles. It's called the Nickel Diner. And a woman who bought it, just a lovely woman, was a friend of Molly, who was our line producer. She gutted there was a shell inside of a shell. Someone had redone the actual interior of the building. She knocked those walls down, and a perfectly preserved 40s diner was behind those walls, which is the diner that's in that movie.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so she went in, reconditioned everything, all the, you know, the painting, all the layout, everything was sort of buried behind these, you know, tacky, whatever someone else had put up to do, and brought it back. And they're famous for their donuts and all this sort of stuff. So I was like, that's what I want to shoot. But I think the most interesting thing as a director is I thought to myself, well, you know what? If you really were in the 40s, no matter how impressed I was with the location, you would be casual about filming it. You wouldn't have languid pans of, like, the producer in you is like, hey, we got this place. We got to cover everything. You know, I want to film down here and show this and that. And I said, you know what? I mean, have the conversation be so intimate that most of the time focus falls off by the time you reach their ears. So even though you have this diner and it's beautiful and textured and everything to create the 40s, at the end of the day, the more important thing was when the conversation needed to be intimate, the rest of the world fell away. Even the diner wasn't, you know, full frame in the thing. And only a few times when you felt like the world intruded on them, I went wide with deep focus and you got a sense of that diner. But the casualness of it. You know, it'd be like if we made a film in the 80s. If you were in the 80s and you went to an arcade, you wouldn't go, ooh, look, I'm in an arcade. I'm going to pan all the stuff. You'd be like, it's just an arcade. Everybody sees an arcade. And so I had to be very careful when I got a great location like the Nickel Diner not to overcover it as if it was something of a big deal, because there would have been dozens of those diners along that area at that time. And so, to me, it makes you believe a lot more that that's their environment you're in, because you don't make a big deal out of it.
The house, also I want to discuss. I love the look of the house.
Yes. The house is based on photo composites of a lot of houses here. There's only one or two shots that were actually in the house. The rest had to be created through photo compositing.
I thought you were. I knew you played tricks on me.
Yeah. And one thing I love about it is when the mom is talking, the fire behind her rages a little hotter whenever she gets hotter.
I didn't see that. Yeah. I'm sorry. I would have made a note. I missed that.
Yeah. And then when she talks about the husband, like the film Laura, his portrait is looming over her shoulder at all times, listening. And then the missing person has a chair next to me. I'm alone outside of their family system by being seated on the other side of the table, and the rest of the family is all together. And so in classic sort of murder mystery thing, we literally set the table with the cast of characters, and those characters are revealed through the dinner and them talking. But you see the kind of luxury and the old money there, and it's very kind of genteel at first, and then it starts to become more ascetic, and you start to see all the different power struggles in that family. And I love that dinner scene, and I love the way the house turned out. It's just, it captures that house that you see in so many, you know, you even see it in Maltese Falcon. It's like, it's that old money house. It's so LA, and it just works. It's a character in the film.
Now, I do want to discuss the cemetery. Were the holes dug, or I'm just fooling me the way you dumped them, the way you shot it?
Yeah, there were no holes there. We were not allowed to touch anything.
I was so wondering that, because I'm like, the way you're shooting, like, he's not letting me know.
Yeah, that again, was sort of a conceit that I, because of, you know, the nature of the plot where I came up with that forensic idea, it's such a simple idea, but it actually would work.
It was.
So they found, you know, these cemetery plots for me, and I looked at them, and they said, look, the only thing is don't touch anything. Obviously, they're dead people here. And so I was like, well, in order to pay that off, I have to create I set up a tracking system where I could then add what I needed to track into it. And because everything else was real, your brain put everything else together.
So what did you do for your costuming? Because it seems very authentic.
There's a lot of authentic costumes. It's funny. One of the costume that I'm wearing is Drake. My dad is of an older generation. That is the suit that he wore the day he was married. And he'd only worn it once, and I was able to fit into it, but it actually is from the period. It's actually a 40s suit that had been worn once by him when he gave it to me. He's like, hey, you ever think you need something like this? And I kept it in my closet. And I thought, you know what? I should wear my dad's suit. And as a little Easter egg, the scene by the phone when his partner comes over, there's two pictures on the wall.
Yes.
One of the pictures is my dad wearing that suit that I wore in the opening scene in The Office. That's him getting married in that suit.
I do remember the shock. You definitely focus on that picture.
Yeah, and that's the suit, a real suit. The rest of it, Eric Shane Johnson, who is a great costumer, and Chantal Filson, I found, and they knew so many ways to either rent, like the gold sort of outfit that Brittany wears when she comes in, that's actually a Veronica-like dress that we re-rented from a Hollywood costume place. They have all the costumes that people wore in 40s films are still there. You just have to be able to get in them, you know, and so we found that dress and it fit Brittany perfectly. Some of the other ones I had them go out and find, and then others were, you know, thrift store stuff that they were able to put together. But one cool thing about LA is so much of the costume history is stored in warehouses and in thrift stores and all these places that if you get savvy people together, and we spent a lot of time looking, like Brittany and I went shopping for dresses forever and found some great ones. But if you look, they are still there. And so all the costumes are authentic to the period.
Now, I guess that's a weird question. Did you return the costumes? I mean, obviously you purchased them at Goodwill, some of them. Some of them were rented. Did you return the Goodwill ones, or did you keep them for another film?
I have a thing in my garage of a lot of the costumes that we ended up buying. The rental ones, the expensive ones, particularly ones that Brittany did, we had to return.
Of course.
You know, you could rent them for 4 weeks, and then you have to, you know, dry clean them and return them and do it. But anything that was purchased, I did save because it shortens the distance if I want to do something else.
I can ask those questions because I have no idea. How much does it cost to rent a dress?
A dress like that, I think, ran me for 4 weeks. I think it was $370, something like that. But then it's not too bad. But, you know, you have insurance. You have to have $1 million insurance policy.
What?
And then well, what if someone destroys it? It's a dress that Veronica Lake wore.
I guess I never thought of it.
Yeah, and then you have to dry clean and have it very specially cleaned. So, you know, all in and returning it, you probably spent between $500 and $700.
Oh, wow.
For one dress.
See, things I had no idea about.
Yeah, and Giordano, who plays the mom, is wearing a rental dress as well from the period that's beautiful. That black dress that she's wearing is just perfect for her. I had her voice in my head when I was writing the character. She literally is the embodiment with that, you know, the timbre of her voice and the way my direction to her was like, speak as if you've never been interrupted and speak as if you never take a breath and you're spitting acid the entire time.
She did do that.
Yeah.
She did.
And if she were in the 40s, she would rule as a character actress.
Oh,
She would be in everything.
She would be. It would be Agnes Moorehead all over again.
Absolutely. Or even Eve Arden with that voice. Yeah.
That's true. She could be Eve Arden. Yeah, seems to look like the same kind of movies. Your music. You definitely give me lots of music. I didn't feel it was a 40s sound, though. I felt you got more like an 80s sound.
Yeah, the problem, well, music is very, very, very expensive. If you want to do something with an orchestra, I had budgeted it out. It was about $120,000 to record a track. And so that being as much as the movie, I said, what are the other options we have? And I had two composers that were very enthusiastic, but more importantly, I am a nut for soundtracks. I have hundreds and hundreds of film soundtracks. I could tell you, you know, a scene by its soundtrack faster than I can sometimes by a clip. And so I wanted a John Barry, Bernard Herrmann kind of feel to this. And so I temped some stuff with that, and I played it for Hayden Clement and Thomas Chase Jones, and they said, look, what you want is impossible, but, you know, we have samples and keyboards and stuff that we can do that we can get you close, because my feeling was music and sound is, you know, elevates the visuals, and for me music is really everything, like it, particularly the end of the movie, it comes alive with that swelling music over top of it. It's hollow without it. You know, you look at Star Wars without the music, it's hollow.
I agree.
And so I said, you know what? Let's get as close as we can and make I insisted on leitmotifs for every character and hummable songs, hummable themes in it, because so many soundtracks now noodle. You know, I'll hear like a Harry Potter, mid-period Harry Potter soundtrack, and it'll be a guy I really like Patrick Doyle, and he noodles for 90 minutes. There's not one theme you can hum or that jumps out at you, and you're like, oh my God. So I thought, let's get that, you know, da, 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 da. And there's a couple of little themes that you can actually hum. And I was like, okay, with what we have, let's make it sound as good as we can. And they did. And, you know, saying it's the 80s, it's like, I know I was going to take that ding because I don't have the Seattle Orchestra recording.
Sorry, it wasn't a ding. You know,
if they did, that would be one hell of a soundtrack, because played by a full orchestra, I guarantee you, you'd be like, is this Bernard Herrmann? What is this?
Wow. Okay. I do have a scene issue, and you can tell me if I'm totally crazy. It's when the PI is outside yourself, and you're outside the house, and you fall.
Yes.
I thought you were two stories up. Maybe it's just me looking at the shot. Maybe it's the way you shot it, because then you fall. And I'm like, shouldn't he have fallen further?
No. He's able to, if you notice, I'm actually able to reach up almost and grab onto the thing you have.
Yeah. He's wrong.
With houses like that, the bottom windows, actually, unlike houses now sometimes, the window sills sometimes started at the ground on those stone houses. So if I reach up and go along that little bar, I'm about, 8 feet, 9 feet above to look into what would be the bedroom level of it. For a house like that, it's actually based on a real house. So he falls, but, you know, he only drops about, you know, 5 feet, 6 feet. He'd probably be killed if he dropped two stories.
Well, that's what I was confused. Yeah. I said, maybe it's just my eyes playing tricks. So I brought it up to ask.
Yeah, no, absolutely. If you look at the window that he's standing at when he reaches up, that window is at ground level.
Okay. See? There you go.
And one thing I like about that is I really did build something to climb along, which was kind of fun. We decided to leave the piping that I'm climbing on as part of the construction of the building. And so I got way up there, did that, and then we just composited him in. So we didn't try and hide it, you know, by creating some kind of artificial thing, because it would bend with my weight. It would jiggle around. It would take forever to turn it into, you know, something else. And they didn't really have, the drain pipes and that type of thing back then. So I thought, well, let's just use what's really there, which was actually a 2x4.
Oh, there you go. Okay, we haven't discussed the butler.
Yes, Rivers.
Rivers sees and hears nothing.
Yeah,
he says. Love Rivers. Absolutely good casting on Rivers. I'm going to give you full remarks. I quite enjoyed Rivers.
Yeah, I did too. And he's a multi-layered character, which is interesting. His insanity has an internal logic. But what I love is right from his introduction, she says, I feel beside myself without my Wilson. And she gestures to him. And I'm thinking it's perfect because she is beside herself.
Yes.
there's a very subtle line that gives it away right there at the dinner table. And then, you know, Mark Tyke played Rivers completely just lost himself in it. He's like, look, I'm going to just trust it and go with it. And actually, there's a precedent for characters like that. There's a little Betty Davis in there.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of insanity. There's a little Otto Preminger in there as well. From Sunset Boulevard.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm glad you like that character. And there are always people like that where it's like, Rivers? No, honestly, no. You know, people that have to say that, you know, are lying.
So I just want to discuss something. Rivers does something later in the film.
Mm-hmm.
Changes his look slightly. I don't want to ruin it for anybody.
Right.
I put WTF right beside that. I was like, didn't see that coming.
That's good. To me, that's the twisted. You'll notice when we go out of our way to say, hey, we're a normal family, Mr.
Yes.
Drake.
I'm like, okay.
But that is the sort of sub and dominant thing that often went on back then. I mean, let's think about Hoover back then.
Yes.
He super identifies with her. And when the father is in question, you know, when something may have happened to him, he steps into both that role and still sycophantically kind of servicing her and loving her in a weird way.
Oh, yeah,
but,
for sure.
But his identity is tied up. And I think what made it really work for me is there's a line very towards the end of the incident you're speaking of where he talks about her in a kind of first-person, third-person way and gives a very ominous thing about what happens to her.
Yeah.
And I thought, that is just creepy.
It is.
You know, because he's okay with it.
He is.
Yeah.
I totally think he's okay.
Yeah, he's okay with whatever twists go in. And to me, that's a great noir character because his moral compass is completely broken.
Okay, we haven't talked about the police detective. I don't want to leave him out.
Yes.
Excellent. Excellent. Works perfectly on all levels.
Yes. Vernon Wells is a pro. I had him in mind for this. I have a very funny story about him. If you wrote this as a script, you'd be like, Tom, really? I was 21 maybe, when I moved to L.A., and I was working at a Circuit City for Christmas help because I had just graduated from film school and drama school, and I needed some money. So in walks, I would say 1990 maybe, 1989, in walks Vernon Wells. And it's the first celebrity I ever saw in L.A. when I moved here. And so I go up to help him, you know, this kid bounds up, and I'm like, Vernon Wells from Road Warrior Commando, I can't believe I'm talking to you. He was super nice to me, but he was like, yeah, kid, okay, well, thanks a lot. And I go, one day, I want to do something with you. And he kind of looks at me like, yeah, right, like I don't hear that. So 23 years later, we end up in a casting together for a commercial, and we're supposed to be on safari, and it's he and I. And I look over at him and I'm like, I met you when you first moved here. I've got this film project I would love to do with you. So I send him the script and he goes, oh, it's actually good. I'm like, I'm a man of words. I'm not just a brute. And I'm like, exactly. I think you could do something with this and we could make him a very interesting character. And so literally by the time we got the thing rolling, 24 years after this kid said, one day I'm going to do something with you, Vernon Wells was the star of my first motion picture.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was amazing. And he was great. He is the antithesis of his character. He is, you know, when you meet him, it's hugs, not handshakes. He builds schools and facilities in other countries for, you know, disadvantaged children. He rescues animals. He's the sweetest, nicest guy. But when he turns on that engine of menace, and he understands how people abuse power as a character, and he is a pro at it. He can turn it on. I was terrified. I was really tied to that chair because I wanted it to be real when he's interrogating me with the punches. So
oh,
that
I
was
thought
a trust.
For sure you were really tied. I thought there was no doubt about that.
Yeah, and so there's a level of trust there you have to have when someone's swinging at you. And, you know, I look up, and of course, you know, 20-year-old me is going, oh, my God, you know, Vernon Wells is beating me up in a movie. But also, he's such a pro that I never had any doubt. I allowed my character to be vulnerable, and to me, acting is about being vulnerable. And he, you know, he does a number on Drake. And a lot of that is real. I mean, when he gut punches me and goes after it, we had a level of trust where it's like, go for it. Let's just do it and
so
get it right.
So he really does punch you?
A couple of them landed, yeah.
Okay. It looked like to me, because I'm like, I don't think he's pulling those.
No, a couple of them landed, and that's why I had him with the gloves on, just in case.
Yeah, well, he's a big, he's 6'6",
I think. He's huge. You don't want to mess with him. Yeah.
No, I would definitely not.
But what a pro. He remains a friend to this day. We went to lunch about a month or two ago, and he's like, Tom, I would do anything with you on it. It was some of the best stuff that I've done since Road Warrior, which I thought was a great compliment. And then he said, you know, I have some projects I'd like to do. And someone saying that is such an endorsement that they trust you. You know, half of the battle with anything creative like this is, do people have your back? And if he feels like I have his back and I want to show him in the best light and give him something juicy to kind of chew on, that to me is worth everything, because the director in me and the actor in me is going, great. He felt like I had his back, and we got a great performance together, and we made much with what little we had.
Well, that's great. I do want to discuss the nice-looking old cars is the last thing I want to go over.
Yes.
Beautiful-looking cars.
Beautiful cars, all authentic to the period. To me, one of the things when I was storyboarding and doing kind of pre-visualizing on it, something I wrote on a note was, nothing gives away period faster than the cars.
Correct.
It makes you feel like you're there. And Dave Beeler, who plays Lou McDonald, my partner in this, saw a news broadcast about the Automobile Driving Museum. And this guy named Earl Rubenstein. And he had it where you could go to the museum and drive the cars. Say on the weekend, you know, you had a guy named Paul who actually plays the cabbie in the film.
He's the one who smoke.
He runs the car museum. So we went down there and we explained to him what we wanted to do, and he kind of got a smile on his face, and he's a really kind guy, and he's like, so basically you want to make the cars drive around and you want to look like you're in it. And it turns out his son works in the movie business too, doing effects. And I said, look, I'll try and not, you know, make too much of a pain on myself, but is there any way we could use your cars to make this film more real? Because otherwise, you know, we're going to have a problem, because you got to have some cars to just feel like you're there. And he's like, absolutely. So he opened up his business and the whole thing to us. And, you know, I've been kind of tweeting about the Automobile Driving Museum and all this kind of thing. I go, look, thank you so much for doing it, because he let us in there a couple days, and we shot all that dialogue in the cars, and we drove them around, and we got the police car, all the vehicles in that are from that museum. And that just made the film, because the script had already been written with all of those car things happening, like that really funny scene where the cabbie's there and the car pulls up and he's like, I'm waiting for a fare.
I love that scene.
At the cemetery.
That was funny. That was funny.
If you didn't have good cars, that doesn't work.
No, not at all.
Yeah. And they look brand new. Well, So hats off to Earl and to Paul. They just came through for me in a way that made the film so much better. And I with the cars, again, I had to be casual about it. I mostly shot interiors. I couldn't kind of languidly pan over the cars as if they were something. Because if you look at old 40s movies, they just get in the car.
Correct.
And drive, you know? And it's, as much as I was like, oh, my God, this Plymouth is just beautiful. But you will notice I staged a couple of scenes, like when the guy in the black hat comes and sits with her and there's that creepy scene.
Yes.
I have the dashboard and you see old cars passing.
Yes.
And in the alleyway and everything. To me, that just sets up a beautiful sense of place. And you're like, yeah, okay, I'm there. I'm in the 40s, and this is real.
I just want to go back to that restaurant. I think that really helps you, too.
I agree.
And right off your opening shot, you establish it. If you're a noir fan, you get it as soon as you start the film. And
yes.
I don't think you've ever broken that, except for the music, and you told me why you had to break it with the music.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that's the only time I really felt it wasn't noir was the music.
Yeah.
But that's
fine. We don't have an orchestra. Yeah, absolutely. But the diner did give it a great sense of place, and the fact that we could anchor it there. I I wrote that line of dialogue where she goes, "Hey, have you heard of the Orlov?" And he's like, "No, good food." Yeah. You know, and then you realize it's the Orlov Diamond. It was like the perfect introduction to the diner while also being kind of a Chandler-esque witticism where he's like, he thinks the place is called the Orlov, yeah. You know, because he doesn't go out much.
No, he doesn't. So, I think that's yeah. He doesn't have $1.47 for coffee.
Exactly. And Lou knows exactly how much it costs because he's a really, really good detective.
He states that. Lou does yeah. state that.
Yeah. He is the mirror image of Drake, where appearance is more important. And we kind of play on that a lot with their relationship that, you know, they're like brothers, but one is much more about the suit. And they're people like that, where it's like, hey, I'm not going to pull up in Hugo. I'm going to pull up in this. And his eye for detail is reflective of Roland also has an eye for detail, but it's clouded by the emotions that he has for Jennifer Montemar. And also he has been so beaten down by life, you know, by being framed and all the problems that he has with police corruption that he can't be like Lou anymore. Lou is the affluent. He kind of lives in the rare air and just takes the cases he wants.
Yeah.
And so I wanted them by being together. There's that level of trust at the end that it's ironic that someone like Lou will come through for him because Lou is all about appearances and he needs to do something where appearances are not what's important. He needs to do what's right.
Well, that's it for me, but I do have fun questions for you that everybody likes.
All right.
So I was listening to, I usually have different ones because you probably haven't heard an interview, so you're going to have different ones.
Okay.
Just because of something you said. Your favorite movie soundtrack?
Ooh. It's like picking a favorite child.
Give me a few.
I would say it's a toss-up. Vangelis's Blade Runner and probably, you know what? I mean, I really love John Barry's On Her Majesty's Secret Service. I love that soundtrack.
I love that film, so that's fine.
I love that one. So I would say it's between those two and about 100 other soundtracks that are just racing.
Okay.
Yeah, huge John Williams fan, obviously, but it's like, you know, do I pick Raiders? Do I pick Close Encounters? Or, you know, it's sort
how
of...
Pick Raiders?
What's on my playlist right now would be that.
It's Friday night. I guess you have parties. You put on soundtracks, I presume, over music.
Yeah.
What do you put on?
I would probably start with, I've been listening to Vertigo a lot just because I enjoy it. I like it. And people are like, what is that? I recognize that. I might also, you know, mix it up. Definitely. What I like to do is like find connective tissue. Like I'll have a thing. My son is really good on soundtracks. Like we've been listening to him forever. He's 13, but I can play a soundtrack. And from the other room, I'll hear him go, the car is driving by a mountain. It's this scene. The name of the track is this. He's like, that's Thor Dark World. That's the funeral scene, you know? And I'm like, wow, you know? So I will try and we'll play a game where we'll do connective tissue. I'll be like, what's the connective tissue between this? And it might be the Shark Cage Fugue by John Williams, which then is echoed in his soundtrack when he does E.T. There's the same motif from it.
Wow.
And then I'll leap forward in that into something else. And I'll be like, here's a guy who's influenced, like Michael Giacchino. He's doing a John Williams riff from this in this incredible soundtrack.
Look at you go, man. You're hardcore.
Yeah.
You're hardcore.
Yeah. Very hardcore. I love movie soundtracks. There's a guy named Daniel Biesbaum that I want to work with who I think is going to be my John Williams. He did, you know, the opening of the movie, that logo for Luminactus that comes up?
Yes.
He composed that. And he also did the trailer music for the film.
I have not watched
that. That was done by him, not by the composers. And his ear, when I first heard the logo music, like I was like, that's my company logo music. I love this. But it had that kind of Williams quality. It had it just sounded like it had always been.
Okay. Well, the last question is a normal question I asked. You're going to movie theaters. Where do you buy the concessions then?
I am probably a Milk Duds guy. And, that's completely stupid, but I love those new machines where I can actually get, like, ginger ale flavored with vanilla and lime.
I'm with you 100 on board.
I love that, and I'm always like, okay, it's like too many choices. But I'm definitely that guy. I will sometimes get popcorn, but I am watching my weight, so I probably will get some candy and share it around.
Well, and last question, last movie you saw in theaters?
The last movie I saw in theaters was Infinity War.
That's everybody's choice lately. Everybody tells me Infinity War. I'm like, all I got to ask. Well, I want to thank you for your time. I hope this was good for you.
Absolutely. I really enjoyed talking to you. I'm so grateful that you appreciated the film on the levels that you did, and any chance, you know, for somebody to help shine a light on it, I'm grateful for. So I really appreciate this.
Well, thank you so much. You have a great day.
All right, you too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
And check out troubleismy.biz if you want to find out where to see it.
There you go, people. Go there. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.